We're going to start a new chapter. What is Romanticism exactly? It's important to note that it's a movement that is more or less contemporary with the Enlightenment. So it's taking place at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century. What's happening is that an increasing number of artists, philosophers, writers are protesting against the all too strong and in their eyes all too naive rationalism of the Enlightenment. So it's particularly taking place in the arts. It's a movement which you can situate in literature, in music, in the visual arts, and also to a certain degree in philosophy. The emphasis of these thinkers and artists is on, in the first place, the irrational, not the rational, but the irrational, the emotional, that which is overwhelming and cannot be controlled by reason. In the second place, their focus is on what falls outside of civilization. So let's say the uncivilized, for instance, popular culture, for instance, the culture of the child, spontaneous culture. Think, for instance, of what's happening in Germany at the beginning of the 19th century. People like Brentano or people like the Brothers Grimm are collecting folk tales, collecting fairy tales, collecting popular songs, and for the first time, they, as elite intellectuals, are taking an interest into that kind of material, which is quite unique, which is a new thing. In the third place, there is an interest in the exotic, that which deviates from Western civilization, which falls outside of Western civilization, and which the Romantics search for in either another time, so there's a new interest, for instance, in the Middle Ages, or which they search for in another place, in an exotic locale. For instance, Orientalism emerges. Let's have a look for some examples at the visual arts of the period. For that, I'm going to have a look at a few artists which are quite popular, which you might know. The first, I'm going to look at a number of paintings, and the first of which is painted by the British artist William Turner. The painting is called The Fighting Temeraire. It's from 1838, and it's a very famous painting. It was actually voted the nation's favorite painting. I mean here, the English nation's favorite painting by BBC4 listeners. Already in its own time, this was a very successful painting. Probably because of what it shows. It really touched a nerve, this work. What it shows is this image in the background, an old warship, painted in ghostly colors. You can almost not make it out. It's very finely detailed, but it's also very pale. And then it's towed by a steamboat. And what happens is the events being depicted here are the old warship, the Temeraire, being towed to the shipyard where the ship will be broken up. As you can immediately see, if you look at the painting, is that it has these huge visual contrasts. The old warship is painted in ghost-like colors, as I said, and this is contrasted with this dirty black tugboat with its tall flaming smokestack. It's like a contrast of the old versus the new. The old, the grand, the refined, versus the new, the dirty, but also the power of the steamboat. Now, why this painting was so successful, we can imagine, is because the Temeraire referred to the glorious past of the British Royal Navy, since this very ship had been instrumental for Admiral Nelson to win the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. And what you could see happening in the painting is a kind of cultural anxiety, an anxiety about whether this old and grand reputation of the British Navy would still hold on in a new age, because a new age is coming. It's the age of sail, which is coming to an end. The warship represents the old age, and it's a new age, the age of steam, that is emerging. So the anxiety here is, will the old survive into the new? And the painting answers it rather in the negative, because the warship will be broken up, and we see the sun setting in the background. So this, it has this atmosphere of decline. It's a nostalgic look back to the glorious past of the British Navy and a frightened look ahead to the future of steam-powered ships. What is remarkable is the role that nature plays in this painting. The sunset emphasizes the feelings of decline, of undoing, of an age coming to an end. These same topics are also at work in the paintings of a German artist by the name of Caspar David Friedrich, a very popular, very well-known German romantic artist. Some famous paintings by Friedrich are Der Wanderer über dem Nebelmeer, which you could translate as The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, 1818, or the famous painting The Ruins of Eldena Abbey, Klosterruine Eldena by Greifswald, as it's called in German. Let me focus on that last painting. The painting of the ruins of Eldena Abbey show a beautiful medieval abbey that is in a complete state of ruin. Nature is taking over. Plants and trees are growing over it, in it. In the work of Friedrich, there is clearly an interest in nature, but it's not nature in the old sense, not nature in the sense of a welcoming environment for mankind. It's not a well-ordered, humanized nature. Let's say nature in the sense of a garden or a piece of farmland. It's an image of nature, which we get here, of nature after mankind, nature overrunning the ruins of human structures, a nature that is indomitable, that is threatening, and that will continue to exist long after humans have disappeared from the face of the earth, which is a remarkable departure from the views of the Enlightenment. Enlightened philosophers always considered humans to be the crowning achievement of creation, the pinnacle of nature, while for the Romantics, humans have clearly fallen from their previous high status. Friedrich, I want to add, this is more like a side note, but he's also the author of a quote which is highly significant of the philosophy behind Romantic art. Friedrich wrote, "The artist's feeling is his law," end of quote, which is a stark contrast to the emphasis on reason during the Enlightenment. You should not always let reason win over the feelings, says Friedrich, which is something quite new at that time to be said. In this sense, may I emphasize how decisive the influence of the Romantics has been. Today, still, we believe that for an artist, what is important is his intuition, is his feeling. You could say this today, as an artist, you could say the artist's feeling is his law, and this would be understood by everybody. It would be accepted by a great many people. It was a departure from what was believed by enlightened artists who believed in reason. Okay, and to really drive my point home, one last artist I want to discuss, which is more or less unavoidable, incontournable, as they say in French, is Goya, of course, the Spanish painter Francisco Goya y Lucentes. Especially, I want to point out his engraving, The Sleep of Reason Gives Birth to Monsters. It's a very famous work. And for me, it's emblematic of Romanticism. It's really like, for me, it symbolizes what's happening in Romanticism. What we see is a man who is fallen asleep. He's someone doing intellectual work because he's sitting behind a desk and there's papers scattered all over his desk and a pen we also see. But he has fallen asleep. And now there's this huge crowd of animals, this mass of animals that's emerging from behind him. We see owls, we see a tiger, we see bats, all kinds of animals of the night. And what Goya is depicting here, which is clearly readable from the title of the work, is what happens after reason. What happens when the author has fallen asleep and all kinds of monsters and wild animals appear. These animals are, you could say, the visualization of the nightmares and the half-conscious obsessions and fears of the writer behind his desk. Now, Goya, as a bit of background, Goya painted many large works commissioned by the Spanish court and the aristocracy, such as monumental painting Charles IV of Spain and his family, in which he also depicted himself standing behind his easel. And Charles IV was an enlightened ruler, just like his predecessor, who tried to put many of the ideals of the Enlightenment, such as technical progress and economic political progress, into practice. But these ideals were smashed by the bloody violence of the French Revolution. The revolution which was supposed to embody the ideals of the Enlightenment, which in practice led to the Napoleonic Wars, the wars waged by Napoleon in France and in Europe as a whole, in the beginning of the 19th century. Especially in Spain, the Napoleonic Wars had been very brutal. Napoleon invaded Spain in 1808, and it led to a long drawn-out war between Spanish and French forces, with many atrocities being committed from both sides. For Goya, as an artist, these events are the shadow side of the Enlightenment, which can clearly be seen in his series of engravings that is called The Disasters of War. We see these grotesque images of bodies being torn apart, of almost becoming like a comical image, but it's not. It looks like a joke, but then a very cruel joke. It looks like an image too grotesque even for hell itself. And what you can see here is that painters such as Goya increasingly criticize the ideals of the Enlightenment and the emancipatory project of reason. If we look at other disciplines such as literature and music, I'm going to be rather brief about this topic. But what you can see is that in addition to the attention to nature, there is also a new appreciation of feeling that is very characteristic of Romanticism. Just to give you one quote in English literature, William Wordsworth, as well as Samuel Taylor Coleridge, John Keats, Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, are very important names, very important writers. And I just want to give you one quote by Wordsworth. He said that poetry should begin as, I quote, "the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings," end of quote. So that really sums it up for me. The poet has to mold his emotions into art. That's what he should do. So to conclude, Romanticism, you can say, stands for irrationalism after the Enlightenment, a fascination for all that which escapes the domain of reason. Good. Let's continue with the first philosopher I want to discuss in this chapter, which is Edmund Burke. Now, Edmund Burke is an 18th century Irish politician and philosopher, and to call him a romantic philosopher feels a bit wrong, because Burke himself would probably not have agreed with that designation. That is because most of his work was done before the word Romanticism was introduced and became popular in the English language. You could call him, and this would be more accurate, I think, an early pioneer of Romantic ideas, both on the level of his political philosophy as well as in the domain of aesthetics. Let's have a look at his political philosophy first. So, to understand Burke, you need to understand the Enlightened philosophy of politics. Enlightenment philosophy of politics focused on the idea of a changeable society. What I mean by that is that it asks itself the question, is society a human construction or is it a natural fact? And the answer of the Enlightenment philosophers to this question was quite clear. Society is a human construction. And it comes about through a conscious agreement, which is the social contract, according to the well-known term introduced by Jean-Jacques Rousseau in his book by the same name, The Social Contract, from 1762. You could say that the book is the philosophical blueprint for the French Revolution. This is the beginning of the idea of social engineering. We as human beings are not obliged to accept the existing social order forever, simply because it is here. Society is a human product, just like a hammer or a chisel or a steam engine. So if that product no longer functions adequately, a new one should take its place. In that case, for instance, the government loses its legitimacy in case it abuses the state monopoly on violence by using violence against its own citizens. For some Enlightenment philosophers and politicians, the idea of social engineering and changeability concerned all aspects of society, including religion. This becomes quite clear from a remarkable phenomenon during the later years of the French Revolution, namely the establishment by the revolutionaries of a new religion called the Cult of the Supreme Being, Culte de l'Être Suprême. Now, this might sound strange because the French Revolution is infamous for its fiercely anti-clerical violence. The church was a representative and a pillar of the old order, the Ancien Régime, and it had to be fought by fire and by sword. On the other hand, that did not mean that the revolutionaries were radically anti-religious per se. They were anti-clerical in the first place. So, might not surprise that they began to establish a religion based purely on rational ideas. This is the cult of the supreme being that I mentioned. The idea for this religion came mainly from the revolutionary Maximilien Robespierre, who wanted to establish a religion naturelle, or natural religion, based on A, the recognition of the existence of a supreme being, and B, the immortality of the human soul. Serving this religion had to be done mainly by celebrating and honoring the civic virtues, such as friendship, brotherhood, youth, happiness, etc. And Robespierre even went so far as to organize a new liturgy for the supreme being. He believed that popular meetings, mass gatherings of as many members of the community as possible, had to be a crucial part of this liturgy. Again, following the ideas of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The philosopher from Geneva, Rousseau, had written about the philosophical fantasy of a community coming together to enjoy the spectacle of its own being together. In his own words, I quote, "Let the spectators become an entertainment to themselves. Donnez les spectateurs un spectacle." This is a quote from his 1758 book on the theatre, The Letter to D'Alembert. Robespierre follows those same lines set out by Rousseau when he writes, I quote again, "Man is the grandest that can be found in nature, and the most magnificent spectacle that exists is that of a great people coming together," end of quote. This is a quote from 1794. And in that same year, on the 8th of June, or according to the revolutionary calendar, that was the 20th prairial of the year 2, because they also invented a new calendar, the Feast of the Supreme Being was being held in Paris. Taking place on the Champ de Mars, it was designed and directed by the painter Jacques-Louis David. You will probably know him of his famous painting, The Oath of the Horatians, and also, of course, of his famous painting of the revolutionary Marat dying in his bath, La Mort de Marat, The Death of Marat, painting from 1793. Please look it up. It's gorgeous. It's fabulous. So David designed a special amphitheater to be built in the Tuileries. In the morning of this feast, all the church bells of Paris were ringing. There was cannon fire. There were drums. Next, you had hundreds of actors accompanying the audience to their seats. Robespierre himself was the high priest of this celebration. He entered wearing an extravagant costume with tricolor feathers. All the members of the Convention, so of the National Assembly, you could say, made their entry, and then a hymn was being sung by everybody present. And finally, a cardboard statue representing atheism was set on fire by Robespierre, and when it had almost been totally consumed by the fire, under it there appeared a white plaster statue, and that statue represented wisdom. So keep in mind this image of this new feast, designed in order to celebrate a new artificial religion. So that image of an artificial religion is the very opposite of what conservative philosophers hold true about society. Towards the end of the 18th century, a number of thinkers appear who do not agree with the progressive vision of society and the changeability of society. Most famous one of these conservative thinkers was the Irish politician and philosopher Edmund Burke. He is regarded as the founder of modern conservatism, primarily because of his criticism of the French Revolution in his book Reflections on the Revolution in France. This is a book from 1790. So very early on, when the French Revolution was just taking up speed and almost no one knew what to expect from it, he was already very critical of it. And this actually made him famous. Because many European intellectuals held the very opposite point of view. Think of Immanuel Kant, think of Friedrich Schiller, Friedrich Hölderlin, famous German romantic poets, but also Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the famous philosopher. All of them were very enthusiastic about the events of the French Revolution. While Burke, on the other hand, considered the revolution to be a form of social engineering that could very easily derail. He criticized progressive and revolutionary utopias, which, according to him, could lead to dictatorship and terror, as was actually happening in France and would continue to happen for the next few years. He contrasted such radical forms of social engineering with the liberal political revolutions that were also taking place, such as the American Revolution. Revolutions in which the independent activities of the individuals take a central place and not the activities of the central government. This is not the idea of the politician as a social architect, but rather as a gardener. That's the term that Burke uses. What the politician has to do is he has to eliminate the bad elements from society, and that's all. The individuals will take care of the rest. Politician should not mingle too much with that. Let me just briefly show you how a contemporary conservative philosopher thinks about this. The following, which I will read to you, is a fragment from the book How to Be a Conservative by the English philosopher Roger Scruton, who died just a few months ago. So I quote, "In his reflections on the French Revolution, Edmund Burke argued against the geometrical politics, as he called it, of the French revolutionaries, a politics that proposed a rational goal and a collective procedure for achieving it, and which mobilized the whole of society behind the resulting program. Burke saw society as an association of the dead, the living, and the unborn. Its binding principle is not contract, but something more akin to love." End of quote. So according to Burke, and many conservative thinkers today still agree with him, society is not an invention of human beings, but it is in accordance with our human nature. Now, that being said, let me turn to Edmund Burke's philosophy of art. Burke is famous not only for his analysis of the revolution in France, also for his analysis of the phenomenon of the sublime. The sublime is an important topic from modern philosophy of art, but let me first explain exactly why it is so important. What I want to point out before we dive into the sublime is what I would like to call the invention of aesthetics. So what you have to realize is that for a very long period of time, for centuries and centuries, Western philosophy of art was chiefly concerned with the problem of beauty. All of the Greek and the Roman and the Islamic and the scholastic philosophers, when they discuss philosophy of art, they actually mean philosophy of beauty. And beauty for them is an objectivist concept. There is only one kind of beauty, unique and universal. This changes during the Enlightenment with the increasing importance of subjective taste. David Hume states that beauty is no quality in things themselves. It exists merely in the mind which contemplates them, and each mind perceives different beauty. End of quote. So, now the domain of philosophy of art has become larger. It's not only about beauty anymore, but also about taste. And this is like a blueprint for what will continue to happen during the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries up until today. It's what we'd call the invention of aesthetics. You will see that I have just shifted from using the term philosophy of art to using the term aesthetics. That's not a coincidence, because the term aesthetics also became popular during this very period. The expression aesthetics, in the sense of the theory of beauty, art, taste, and related phenomena, was actually used for the very first time only in the year 1750 by the German philosopher Alexander Baumgarten. So aesthetics, as a separate discipline of philosophy, is an Enlightenment phenomenon, is an 18th century phenomenon. Only this, at this late moment in the development of Western philosophy, do philosophers acknowledge the existence of a discipline such as aesthetics. It's worth our time to go deeper into this for a few moments. Now, Baumgarten, Alexander Baumgarten, he liked the word aesthetics because it derives from the Greek word aesthesis. And aesthesis means perception, or that which can be perceived. For him, aesthetics is the study of taste, and he believes that it can even be seen as a scientific discipline. Just like people make judgments about knowledge using their intellect, they make judgments of taste on the basis of their senses. And just as true knowledge can be distinguished from false or subjective opinions, it should be possible to distinguish the one and unique good taste from our personal, subjective, and possibly false preferences. So for Baumgarten, the science of aesthetics would be a deduction of the rules of artistic or natural beauty. This is surprising, because at the very same moment in time, other philosophers were emphasizing that there could be no one and unique form of good taste. Think of Hume, think of Immanuel Kant. Kant, therefore, will be very critical of Baumgarten's project. You cannot objectify taste, Kant says, because it always depends on individual taste. Kant writes the following, and I quote, "The Germans are the only people who have come to use the word aesthetics to designate what others call the critique of taste. They are doing so on the basis of a false hope conceived by that superb analyst, Baumgarten. He hoped to bring our critical judgment of the beautiful under rational principles and to raise the rules for such judging to the level of a lawful science. Yet that endeavor is futile. For as far as their principal sources are concerned, those supposed rules or criteria are merely empirical. Hence, they can never serve as determinate a priori laws to which our judgment of taste must conform." End of quote. To conclude my brief discussion of Baumgarten, he obviously was an important figure for having introduced the term aesthetics, but his own interpretation of it still sounded quite medieval, actually, in the sense of that he was still holding on to an objectivist notion of beauty, a one and unique taste. And this concept was rightly criticized by Immanuel Kant. Okay, let me switch to the topic of the sublime now. Why do so many authors of the 18th century suddenly start to use the word sublime in order to describe their experiences? Let me first briefly recap the main points of my previous discussion. What we see from the 18th century onwards is the invention of aesthetics and the continuous expansion of the range of questions that could legitimately be considered to be aesthetic questions. By consequence, it might be possible that experiences exist which transcend the field of beauty but are still to be designated as aesthetic experiences, not because they are beautiful, but because of their overwhelming character. For these experiences, the relatively new term of the sublime was used. If you examine the relative frequency of words in the digital Google Books corpus, and you can do so using a tool called the Google Books Ngram Viewer, it's publicly accessible, you will notice that the word sublime suddenly becomes popular during the last decades of the 18th century. It's the same for the word sublime in French and for the word das Erhabene in German, which might be described, which might be grouped as synonyms. So what is the sublime and why did it emerge? Well, it had emerged as a popular expression through the published travel journals of British authors from the 17th and 18th centuries, who experienced both the majestic beauty as well as the dangerous weather of the Alps during their journeys in Europe, which were quickly becoming popular for the elite. It was the so-called Grand Tour. As a side note, to illustrate the increased popularity of such travel books, because they all these aristocrats and members of the bourgeois who made such journeys also published travel books, and they were quickly becoming very popular. How do we know this? How do we know that it's becoming popular? Well, because people are already poking fun of it, making fun of it. Considering travel literature is the same phenomenon, we already find in 1794 a beautiful parody of the sudden popularity of travel books, namely the French book Voyage autour de ma chambre, Voyage Around My Room, by Xavier de Maistre, and it begins as follows, I quote, "I have undertaken and completed a 42-day journey around my room. The interesting observations I have made and the continual pleasure I experienced en route filled me with the desire to publish it." End of quote. So what was so special about the journey, this grand tour that undertook by British and German and other aristocrats during the late 18th century? They had an experience in the Alps which was no longer merely about beauty. It was about something that transcended their field of vision, something that they could not contain in their field of vision. In the Alps, they felt the beauty of nature, but it overwhelmed them, and it might even possibly threaten their life. A very characteristic expression is that used by the English author Joseph Addison. Addison wrote, I quote, "The Alps fill the mind with an agreeable kind of horror," end of quote. Now, how can something be simultaneously agreeable and horrific? What explains our feeling of excitation, even aesthetic appreciation, at the same moment when we become aware of a great danger? In order to explain this phenomenon, Burke wrote a book with the title A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and the Beautiful, published in 1757. At the source of all human activities, Burke explained, there are three fundamental passions. You have curiosity, you have pleasure, and you have pain. Curiosity makes us want to go out into the world and explore it. Pleasure rewards our curiosity for what is beautiful or nourishing or rewarding or interesting, while pain warns us for what is dangerous or hurtful or threatening. Now, our sense of beauty stems from our sensitivity to pleasure, while the sense of the sublime is linked to our sensitivity to pain and to our instinct for self-preservation. And yet we feel good when we are confronted with the sublime. How can that be? Burke explains that the sublime is actually a negative form of pleasure. He also doesn't call it pleasure, but he uses a different word, namely delight. Delight is not the presence of pleasure, but rather the absence of pain. Or the feeling of being in safety, despite being in the presence of something that overwhelms you and might be dangerous for you. Think of the feeling of being inside a house in the mountains while a thunderstorm is raging outside. Or the feeling of standing before a giant aquarium and looking at a shark swimming in front of you. That delight, that absence of pain, could ultimately according to Burke, be a stronger experience than pleasure itself, because pain is a much stronger sensation than pleasure. This is what he wrote himself, and I quote, "Whatever is fitted in any sort to excite the ideas of pain and danger, that is to say, whatever is in any sort terrible, or is conversant about terrible objects, or operates in a manner analogous to terror, is a source of the sublime. That is, it is productive of the strongest emotion which the mind is capable of feeling. When danger or pain press too nearly, they are incapable of giving any delight, and are simply terrible. But at certain distances and with certain modifications, they may be, and they are, delightful." End of quote. The sublime, to be brief, is the feeling that you get when you are in front of the awesome, the awe-inspiring, and you want to take a minute to enjoy the beauty of it, the beauty of a landscape, of a mountain landscape, let's say. But at the same time, you feel somewhat frightened because of there is somewhere a danger present, a danger of weather or an avalanche or a thunderstorm threatening you. These are examples from the world of nature. What are good examples of the sublime in the arts, you might ask? Let me give you two examples, one from the field of literature, another one from the field of the visual arts. An illustrative example from the field of literature is to be found in a typical late Romantic work of literature, namely Moby Dick or The Whale by the American writer Herman Melville, published in 1851. This book, as you know, tells of the doomed quest of Captain Ahab for an enormous, monstrous white whale. He wants to avenge himself and kill the whale. As readers, we experience the excitement and the fears of Ahab's crew, while we, as readers, remain safely in our comfy chairs. And Melville succeeds in capturing the terror of the hunt very accurately. It is no accident that he used the word sublime himself. Let me give you the following quote. "In some particulars, perhaps, the most imposing physiognomical view to be had of the sperm whale is that of the full front of his head. This aspect is sublime." End of quote. Let me conclude this session by giving a few suggestions of where to look for the sublime in the domain of the visual arts, and you will probably have some ideas of this yourself as well. It is precisely the taste for what is rugged and negligent or dark and gloomy, as Edmund Burke himself already put it. For example, the work of the German painter Caspar David Friedrich, which I discussed at the very start of this session. But you can also think of the work of the famous Italian landscape painter Giovanni Battista Piranesi. Piranesi was called a vedutista. A vedutista literally means landscape painter, but a specific kind of landscape painter. He was famous for his vedute, and vedute means in Italian views. It is a special form of landscape painting, mostly in the case of Piranesi, also engravings, which depict recognizable cityscapes very accurately and very recognizably. Now, the increasing popularity of these vedute in the second half of the 18th century certainly had to do with the popularity of the Grand Tour. By buying such paintings and engravings, travelers could obtain a souvenir from their trip, and back at home, it was a way to look back on the highlights of their journey. Piranesi specialized in a number of variants of the vedute, such as the views of ruins and the fantastical vedute. Vedute, you could say, views of imagined buildings, fantastical buildings, which were also called capricci. A very well-known example of the ruin vedute are Piranesi's Vedute di Roma, which are images from an imaginary Rome. Actually, Piranesi exaggerated the ruinous state of many actual Roman monuments in his designs. And what you see in the engravings of Piranesi are, on the one hand, the insignificance of the human figure. Humans become totally, they are literally dwarfed by the enormity of the monumental architecture. The sublime is here present, you could say, in two distinct ways. First, contemporary people are shown as being overwhelmed by the monumental remains of ancient Rome. And second, ancient Rome itself is depicted as being overwhelmed by the power of time. The buildings are ruined and overgrown. Even the grandeurs of Rome could not protect themselves against the ravages of time. That seems like a beautiful note on which to end. So, thank you and goodbye.